We horen op het ogenblik de muziek van Hein van der Gaag. Maar naast me zit de pianist Teddy Wilson. Mr. Wilson, what was the greatest experience, musically spoken, in your life?
Well, there's so many, it's hard to say the one. I think my early experience of becoming acquainted with the music of Fats Waller from recordings, music of Earl Hines from recordings, Louis Armstrong from recordings, before I ever met these men, Big Spider Beck from recordings had such an impact on me that I decided to become a professional musician. I was living in the south of the United States in the state of Alabama in a school where my mother and father taught academically, not in music. And I would say that, plus after making the decision from listening to these men on records to actually meet them after I moved north, and also to come in contact with Art Tatum and later with Benny Carter, would be the most exciting and thrilling experiences I've ever had in music. The men who molded the way I play the piano today, to meet my idols and who I had modeled my playing after, to meet these people in person, it was a very thrilling experience.
But you played years with Benny Goodman.
Yes, I played many years over the years with Benny Goodman, and still do occasionally. We have about four concerts coming up in 1973, spread out in June, July, August, September. One in Chicago, New York, Saratoga, New York, a resort town in the state of New York, another in Pittsburgh. And I also played with Goodman 1962, the tour of the Soviet Union, the first American jazz tour of the Soviet Union. And I was in the Carnegie Hall 1938 concert with Benny Goodman. And it began recording with Benny Goodman as far back as 1934, before either one of us were band leaders. And we were just freelancing around the Europe. So I've had a very long and wonderful association with Benny Goodman.
Perhaps you can tell me more about Billie Holiday. You worked so much with her. You made so many recordings.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? We should like to know something about Billie Holiday.
First, let me say, I made many recordings with Billie Holiday, but I never played in public with Billie Holiday to mount anything. Maybe never over 15 or 20 times over a period of 30 years. When I first met Billie Holiday, she was already a solo performer, and my association with Billie Holiday was on recordings in sessions set up by John Hammond with the old Brunswick Company, which later was bought by Columbia, and I would organize all-star groups to play behind Billie. But Billie was already a featured performer herself, and when I became a band leader, I couldn't afford to hire Billie Holiday as my singer. I had an excellent singer named Gene Elrich. But Billie Holiday, when I first met her, as I said, brought to John Hammond, introduced me to her when she was performing in a little nightclub in Harlem. But she's always been a solo performer. She never grew up as a band singer. But she did sing with Artie Shaw's band at one time for a short while, and then later with Count Basie. But basically, she was a solo performer. So as a result, we never performed together in public except at maybe Newport Jazz Festival, that I recall, and maybe a little bit at nightclubs, isolated incidents. But we made many records together, which is possible the way you get all-star people together. Like the records, the bands behind Billie Holiday that I would organize for those recording dates in the 30s were all stars. Goodman might be on clarinet, Pee Wee Russell, Harry James on trumpet, Roy Elrich on the saxes would be Chu Berry, Ben Webster, Johnny Hodges, Lester Young, and the trumpets would be Bobby Hackett, Jonah Jones, Buck Clayton, Roy, and all star groups in which Billie was like an all-star singer, you see.
And you organized that sessions.
Meteen?
You organized that session,
yeah.
I thought.
Yes, I did. Yes, right. But the organization in the beginning, the arrangements were made by John Hammond. The contracts worked out with Columbia Records and Brunswick Records. So I must give John Hammond credit. John Hammond is one of the last men in America who dedicated his life to jazz. Oh, there's a very wealthy man who would normally have been in the banking business, but he loved this jazz music and came in contact with it as a young man, and this spent his life promoting different people he liked, and also he's still with Columbia Records in charge of reissue. He reissues the old records in new packages, like the Golden Years of Billie Holiday. He reissued that, and he's done a special on me and some of those bands that I organized behind Billy, where she didn't sing, because very often we would do instrumental numbers with no vocals on the record days. And this series started in Tokyo 2 years ago.
I should like to know something about Coleman Hawkins. I'm asking so many musicians already about Coleman Hawkins because I'm preparing a lecture upon Bean. Mm-hmm. Yeah? And I should like to know something about you. Your expression, what did Coleman Hawkins mean to you?
Coleman Hawkins was unique on the saxophone in the way that he could... let's see how I can say it so you understand it. He could play like three voices. He could play the thoughts of like three different saxophone players at once, in the sense that he could, as a matter of fact, he did it when I was here in 1966 with Coleman Hawkins. We played the Concertgebouw Auditorium in Amsterdam, and then we played in The Hague. We played in The Hague. I forget the name of the concert hall there, connected with a big hotel on the river. That's it, absolutely. Coleman Hawkins played September Song as his featured solo number, a very slow ballad, which he's the master of. But also, along with the melody, he would put in a second line, an obbligato, and even a third obbligato, and still the listener could carry the melody and the first and second obbligatos in their mind. And this is unaccompanied. You see, what a great talent that is. No one has ever done that except Coleman Hawkins.
That's right.
That I've ever heard.
That's right.
Hawkins could play like three lines at once, and you retain in your mind the memory of what he had done on the top line when he ran to the obbligato on the second line or the third line. You retain the memory, and they all fit together. A remarkable ability.
That's Coleman Hawkins.
Also, Coleman Hawkins has made to me so far the only perfect jazz solo record. The record he made of Body and Soul in 1939 is the most successful effort of a jazz musician to play 3 minutes on a record. In the old days, 7/8 were 3 minutes long, to make a perfect record where the structure of the record is the improvisation is so perfect, the ideas all fit together and form a unity. So when he's over, it's like a story has been told, and it's just the most perfect example of solo jazz improvisation over an extent that period of time. Because many players now will play for half hour, but they don't build a structure like Coleman Hawkins did in 3 minutes on the Body and Soul record, I think.
That's Coleman Hawkins. That's Coleman Hawkins.
Coleman Hawkins.
For you, yeah. But, and Louis Armstrong. What did Louis Armstrong mean to you?
Louis Armstrong, number one, he had a fantastic ability to go into a world by himself and play the most beautiful trumpet. I worked behind Louis Armstrong years ago with a band that was not good. There had many good musicians in it, but there was not the teamwork, a good band. And in spite of that, Armstrong would go into a world of his own and play some of the most beautiful music you ever heard, undisturbed by the bad sounds behind him. He had a tremendous capacity to do that. and with a pure jazz feeling. Armstrong had maybe the purest American jazz feeling of all the great skilled technicians. I'm not talking about the blues players and the folk players and the but the people who were highly developed in music, like the classical people of Europe. Armstrong, his knowledge of harmony, to express himself on his trumpet, the golden tone he got from his Selma, which was presented to him by the company 40, 50 years ago. He was just maybe the greatest jazz talent out of America ever.
You're not on a record with Louis.
What'd you say?
You're not on a record with Louis.
Yes, the first records I ever made were with Louis Armstrong. There was no piano feature.
No.
Right, in 1933. Some records made in Chicago. Before I moved to New York, I worked for Louis.
Oh, yeah.
But there was no piano feature, so... The first piano feature records that I did... was still in 1933 when I moved to New York and played with Benny Carter on what they call the Chocolate Dandies series of small group records and also big band things of Benny Carter, where I got a chance to be featured and get reviews and criticisms of the jazz critics of those days. The Melody Maker in London, the Jazz Heart in Paris on Hubenasse.
We talked earlier about there's a new film, a new film of the life of Billie Holiday.
Mm-hmm.
That's Return to Billie Holiday. Yeah. This is a film about Billie Holiday.
Yes.
Have you seen it already?
No, I haven't.
You haven't?
No.
And what's your opinion about it in the United States?
Well, the only thing I can say definitely about the film is I have heard on the American radio a great deal of playing of Diana Ross singing Good Morning Heartache, which was one of Billie's specialties. And it's a beautiful rendition of it. And I'm so pleasantly surprised because I had never heard Diana Ross sing outside of the very successful rock group called the Supremes from Detroit. And I had thought of her as a rock singer, but she does a gorgeous job on this Good Morning Heartache, in which I think, in a way, she places herself in the category of the Sarah Vaughans and Billie Holidays and Ella Fitzgerald, Nancy Wilson, Dinah Washington, in that level of singing, out of the rock movement on this Good Morning Heartache record. Now, that's the only thing, concretely, I've heard. And I understand that this song is from the soundtrack of that movie, Lady Sings the Blues. But I have never seen the movie, I've never read the book.
No.
So I can't say for sure.
I love the piano playing of Eddie Heywood.
Yes,
where is Eddie Heywood at the moment?
Eddie Heywood is living in Cape Cod, Massachusetts. He's got a gorgeous home right on the ocean, and he and I play at a little club called The Cookery in New York, which has started a policy of piano music about 2 years ago, owned by a man named Bonnie Joseph, who used to own the Cafe Societies in New York during the Second World War, which were clubs that Hazel Scott came up in, Lena Horne, and many people who became later stars, actors who were not known came up in the Cafe Society. This man, Bonnie Joseph, operated a luncheonette for 20 years, and now he got a liquor license 2 years ago, and he's put in piano players. I play there. Eddie Heywood plays there, and Marion McPartland plays there. Mary Lou Williams plays there. There's just a few of us, and each of us, I do say 6 months out of the year there, and the others do maybe 3 months out of the year. As a matter of fact, I just left there when I came to Holland to join the Dutch String College Band week before last, and I'll be going back in that crockery September 4th, and Eddie plays there regularly. Because Eddie has been so successful with royalties from his original music that he really doesn't have to play the clubs anymore. But he does play the cookery because he enjoys it. One of the most enjoyable restaurant jobs in America, in New York, where people eat, jazz fans come, and although there's food served and everything, the majority of the people are there for the music and the food. The food is good and it's available if they want it.
I can't find no recent recordings of Eddie Heywood.
The last I know would be the big band things he did with Hugo Winterhalter. I haven't been able to check and shop for the record for several years. I've been, on the road, and I live in a little town called Hillsdale, New Jersey, about 20 miles from New York, and what records are available there are mostly in the local supermarket, the current best-selling record, and they don't have a comprehensive list of jazz records. Well, one would have to go to New York City to find the jazz record shop, which, and I get to New York very seldom, unless I'm working, and then that's mostly at night.
Okay. I should like to hear something about Duke Ellington from you.
Duke Ellington?
Duke Ellington.
Oh, Duke Ellington. He is to the written jazz what Armstrong is, say, to the improvised jazz. See, jazz is either improvised by the soloist or either you put it on paper. And many people have felt you can't put it on paper. I think Duke Ellington has been a giant of writing jazz on paper. I think Fletcher Henderson was. A lot of the stuff that he wrote for his own band and for Benny Goodman is classic music, just like Ellington. Benny Carter, I think, has been able to put it on paper. But it's very difficult to write jazz like we associate with classical music, like Beethoven wrote for symphony orchestra, and a first-class symphony can play Beethoven, a first-class concert pianist, a violinist, a string quartet. But jazz is very difficult to write so men can read it and get the feeling that compares with the improvisation. You say Armstrong or the other men we're talking about, Coleman Hawkins, Dizzy Gillespie, and Johnny Hodges, those people. You understand what I mean?
Thank you, Al. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ari.
I was very pleased to meet you here in the Hague Jazz Club.
Yes, thank you. I've enjoyed the evening so much playing here. Lovely audience, and of course I find a real pleasure to be touring once again with the Dutch Swing College Band. This is our second tour. We did one last year, and now this is my second, and we hope to do another one in 1974.
Okay, hope to meet you then again.
Thank you. Bye.